Our show is supported by Be My Guest with Ina Garten, Ina's official podcast from Food Network, back for its fourth season. On every episode, Ina invites a different friend to her home in the Hamptons to talk about life, love, and career, all while cooking up an amazing meal. Join Ina as she crafts a classic cocktail with journalist Frank Bruni and discusses the ins and outs of Yorkshire pudding with actress Emily Mortimer. If you're looking for great conversations about and over good food, tune in to Be My Guest with Ina Garten. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts. Hey, it's Francis, and we did an episode a while ago that is just so salty. I mean that literally, because it's all about amazing salty sauces, fish sauce, garum, and yes, Maggi. We get into how to use them, how they're made, and even some of their history. Check it out. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. You know, if there's one thing my time on this earth has taught me, it's to never underestimate the power of salty brown liquids. Honestly, whenever I'm cooking, and it doesn't matter if it's salad or pasta, soup or stew or a pot of beans, let alone a stir fry, whenever I taste something and it just needs a little oomph, I open my cabinet of salty brown liquids. Whether it's soy sauce, fish sauce, colatura, Worcestershire sauce, ponzu, or something else, these seasonings, mostly fermented and all umami-packed, are the secret weapons in almost every cook's kitchen around the world. They're so essential that you honestly can't imagine much of the world's cuisines without them. So today, we're going to take a swim in salty umami seasonings. We're going to get into great uses for fish sauce with Diep Tran, a terrific Vietnamese chef and co-author of the Red Boat Fish Sauce Cookbook. Our good friend Kushbu Shah of Food & Wine magazine is going to talk about Switzerland's greatest contribution to world gastronomy, Maggi. And we're going to start with a virtual visit to Copenhagen. Noma has been called many times the best restaurant in the world, and their obsession with fermentation has influenced chefs worldwide. They have a whole lab dedicated to fermenting pretty much every edible thing. Like, I've had miso made out of peas, caramels made out of sourdough, and now available to the public is one of their backbone seasonings, a fish sauce-like condiment made out of mushrooms, their smoked mushroom garum. Rene Redzepi is the chef in charge, and we're very happy to have him. Hey, chef. It's great to see you.
Hey, Francis. Good to see you.
It's been a little while, and I am holding in my hands a bottle of smoked mushroom garum, one of the secret weapons of your restaurant, now let out into the world for the first time. So actually, let's start with some definitions. What is a garum?
Oh, well, as many things within food, you know, the definition of something that is ancient to pinpoint exactly where things come from can be hard. But the original garum is thought to date back to the 7th century BC from the ancient Greeks. And there was a word called garos and is referred to in ancient Greek texts. And besides that, there's also numerous casual mentions, suggestion that it was a common ingredient and preservation technique all around the ancient Mediterranean basin.
Okay.
And the preservation technique for garum is quite simple. Back then, you pack whole fish, still with the guts inside, in large amphoras with salt, and then you let time and temperature do its thing.
Okay.
Mackerel was common use. So I think what you could say that garum was the beginning of what we know today as fish sauce.
Yeah, sure. And how did you become interested in it?
Oh, so the story of garum for us is the story of Noma, because the story of Noma is the search for ingredients. And once we found our ingredient base to cook with in the first 3-4 years, we also started noticing that these winters were very long and we didn't have much to cook with. Maybe it's time for us to take, you know, some of the foodstuffs we have in abundance during spring, summer, and autumn and have them in winter. And that's when we dived head deep into what we back then called the preserved kitchen. thinking then that that would sort of define everything preserved, no matter whether it was smoked or salted or fermented. And then obviously at one point we realize that the world of ferments is a universe of its own. Sure. And at one point I stumble across some old literature about a Roman fish sauce called garum, as we called it in the beginning. Mm-hmm. That was the beginning of how we investigated the garums. You know, it started with just reading a book and a quick mention of garums. And that has led us down the rabbit hole that today has become the smoked mushroom garum on your desk in New York City.
Okay, so the big jump, you know, you're talking about an ingredient, a product that, you know, starting from the 7th century BC, so thousands of years old. But through most of its history, I think it was made, as you said, with fish. As you see, you know, and we see obviously today, Southeast Asian fish sauce is a close, you know, material cousin. Mm-hmm. To me, the big difference, obviously, if I'm holding this bottle, it's mushrooms. How did you come upon making this kind of sauce or condiment or seasoning without animal protein?
Yeah. So, well, I didn't think of this. This was our team in the fermentation lab that had the brilliant idea. And I think it's very important to mention this, that I am by no means the fermentation specialist. I have hired people to be specialists in this. And at one point, one of them asks a question. This enzyme that breaks down the fish and releases all the free ammonia acids and makes it turn from fishy to rich umami potent liquid. Mm-hmm. This enzyme we can actually find in the Japanese mold of koji coming from Aspergillus oryzae.
Yeah.
So that was sort of the epiphany, thinking to ourselves, well, can we then use this enzyme to break down other ingredients? And we tested it first with meats, mm-hmm. with beef and lamb and a chicken and duck. And it turns out you can create incredibly tasty, reduced stock garums from beef and so on and so forth.
Oh, cool.
But the big breakthrough for us was because we were searching for flavors that could help us during our vegetarian season here at the restaurant.
Okay.
And so because of having this specific focus, we wanted vegetarian options. And then we knew that mushroom had the umami potential. Mm-hmm. We know that from roasting a mushroom, it can be as delicious as a steak.
Sure, for sure.
And the first one tested was actually Lars Williams that tested that. And he did that with, it's a type of hen of the woods mushroom. I forget the name in English. It's a really, it's a mushroom that grows on trees. Mm-hmm. It was just one of those incredible potent moments when you have 10 cooks standing around a tiny little container, spoons being passed around, everybody tasting it more or less at the same time, and, you know, jaw-dropping moment, because how can this wild mushroom suddenly become this incredible flavor? And that that discovery has led us down another rabbit hole of vegan and vegetarian condiments that we use in our vegetarian season. Mm-hmm. It's something truly powerful to us.
That's amazing. So koji is the star here, right? So koji is the mold you mentioned, and that, mm-hmm. correct me if I'm wrong, that's the mold that is used traditionally in making, well, it's the mold that creates soy sauce, miso, those kinds of ingredients.
Yeah. So it's you grow a mold on typically rice or mm-hmm. In some cases also on barley, mm-hmm. but you can grow them on other grains too. And then that acts as a starting agent for then adding soybeans, salt, and liquid, and then you create soy sauce. Absolutely. Yeah. It's an incredible thing that everybody in the world should know about koji, because so much happiness have come out of koji. You have no idea.
We should really celebrate the things that create happiness.
Mm-hmm. Particularly right now, Koji is happiness.
Yeah, Koji is happiness. That's a great bumper sticker. That's a t-shirts. I'll start making t-shirts. Koji is happiness. So once you start experimenting with this, I'm sure, you know, like you said, you have the lab of 10 or more cooks, you know, who are experimenting. I'm sure they just start throwing everything at this process. Did everything come out delicious, or have there been things where you're like, ugh?
Well, you know, this is subjective.
Deliciousness is learned.
Deliciousness is subjective, as we know. Most of it is culture. How have you been raised?
Sure.
What textures were you fed as a child? Do you love the taste or the aroma of rottening flesh? and so on and so forth, you know. Then you would enjoy many, many things that we have turned into garum. But obviously, if there's a temperature that drops in our fermentation chambers, it could be power outing or something, and some sort of microbial activity increases, then the enzymatic activity then decreases. And the result can be like a sour taste.
Okay.
It's not exactly off. It's not what we want. But to some people, it can be overwhelming. So, no, you need to know what you're doing, obviously. Of course you do. And things can go wrong. But once you have a proper setup and professional people, then it goes really well. When we first start fermenting in a real proper way, you know, we had a scientist with us, Ariel Johnson, to guide us and to make sure that we weren't sort of, you know, kind of chefing it, winging it. you know, it was really, really important to us. So we have a real proper setup now.
Yeah,
absolutely.
And I'll because you seem to be too modest, I will do the job of your publisher and say there's an amazing book on all of this called The Noma Guide to Fermentation.
Which... Oh, I forgot about that. yeah, that's true.
We made I don't even book. Work for them, but I'll do their job for them. We're talking to Renee Redzepi, chef owner of Noma and the co-author of The Noma Guide to Fermentation. We'll be back with more with him in a minute. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. Our show is supported by Hero Bread. You know, for a lot of us, bread has been a staple all our lives. Toast at breakfast, sandwiches at lunch, a nice buttered roll at dinner. It's comforting and delicious, and bread is often what we crave, but sometimes it can sit a little heavy after a meal. That's where Hero Bread comes in. They've created fluffy, delicious versions of the breads that we're used to, but that include no net carbs, 0 grams of sugar, and fewer calories. Oh, and there's more good stuff too, like protein and fiber. Hero Bread has everything from your daily sandwich loaf to tortillas or hot dog and hamburger buns. The products are flavorful and they have something for every craving, from a dressed-up breakfast burrito to a late-night PB&J. They even have monthly small-batch drops of indulgent treats like 2-gram net-carb Hero Croissant or the 1-gram net-carb Hero Cheddar Biscuit. Don't give up being a breadhead. Hero Bread is offering 10% off your order. Go to hero.co and use code TABLE at checkout. That's table at hero.co. Our show is supported by Be My Guest with Ina Garten, Ina's official podcast from Food Network, back for its 4th season. In every episode, Ina invites a different friend to her home to talk about life, love, and career, all while cooking an amazing meal. Listen as Ina does what she does best, make good conversation and delicious food, while making it sound fun and easy. This season, Ina dives into conversation with astronaut and colonel Nicole Mann. As Ina teaches Nicole how to make seared scallops with celery root puree, they talk about everything from family to what foods Nicole really craves when she's in space. And listen in as Ina and Pulitzer Prize-winning writer David Remnick talk about music lessons and the value of developing language skills before joining their spouses for a lively conversation over a comforting dish of chicken parmesan. If you love a good chat over a great meal, you'll love Be My Guest with Ina Garten. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is the show for curious cooks and eaters. We're here with chef and fermentation enthusiast Renee Redzepi, talking about the ancient seasoning called garum, which his restaurant Noma is reinventing. Let's get back to it with him. Okay, so let's talk about this garum, this bottle of garum. I received this in the mail a few weeks ago. I have kept it sealed because I wanted to taste it for the first time with you. Mm-hmm. I know it's not meant to be a condiment eaten on its own, but mm-hmm. I wanna taste it. I've never opened it, I've never smelled it. So let's do that now, and then I wanna talk about how you like to use it.
Super.
So hold on, I'm gonna open this bottle.
Yeah.
Okay, wow. Okay, the smell, I don't know what I was expecting, but it's not totally unfamiliar. It's sort of soy sauce-like, but a little bit lighter.
Mm-hmm. A lot of those ferments have like that distinct kind of recognition towards soy, because although it isn't soy, it's actually very different.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the umami-ness that does that to you.
Yeah, so I'm sure part of what that means is, oh, the smell I associate with soy sauce is in part the soy, but it's also really the effect of the koji and the koji, mm-hmm. how koji breaks 100%. Things down. Yeah. I'm going to taste this. Oh my God. This is bonkers.
I haven't paid him to say this, okay?
Okay. So I assume there's no sugar in this.
No sugar. No, absolutely
but
not.
It really tastes as if there was a very light style of soy sauce that's just a little bit sweeter,
mm-hmm.
but it totally finishes like you just ate the most amazing roasted mushroom.
Mm-hmm.
And like that flavor that lingers in your mouth, it's like that pure aftertaste mm-hmm. of umami, of mushroom umami in particular.
Mm.
This is well.
I think one of the key factors here is that it's low in salt.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and,
it's not very salty.
It's not very salty, and if you add more salt, it will taste more umami rich. We really want the mushroom flavor to shine,
mm-hmm.
and it's lighter, and it's also as a result healthier because there's less salt. But then, you know, we brew ours for about 5 weeks. We could brew it longer. It brews at a 60 degrees Celsius fermentation chamber. And that actually also caramelizes everything.
Okay.
And typically in a soy sauce, it brews for longer, so it's more burnt in flavor.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so we stopped the brewing because we think this is the moment when we hit a product that has an original flavor. You can taste that there's mushroom in here,
mm-hmm.
But it isn't sort of a soy sauce like, if you know
right,
what I mean.
Right. I you wouldn't just be like, I don't have soy sauce, and oh, I happen to have this bottle of Noma's mushroom garum. I'll use that instead. It's not exactly like that.
No, it isn't. It doesn't work like that. We take in this case our mushroom. You know, we made it so that we can produce it for people in their homes. But we have versions here at the restaurant that's made with wild sep mushrooms, mm-hmm. or with wild chanterelles in the season. And we pick 200 kilos in the forest near Copenhagen, and we take them home, and, you know, we serve them on the menu for a couple of weeks, and everything left over, we brew into this golden yellow garum sauce that's so potent of chanterelles. In this case, it's done with organic cremini, I think it's called.
Mm-hmm.
You call it a cremini in America, I think, or brown button mushrooms.
Yep.
Where you simply wash off the dirt, so then you crush them to increase surface area. And then we blend them, and we add salt and pour over water. And then we blend the mixture to a puree.
Mm-hmm.
Once we blended it, we check the temperature. When it cools to 60 degrees Celsius, then we add in the koji and blend again. And then once well mixed, we cover the surface with a pureed mix to prevent oxidation.
Mm-hmm.
We cover the bucket, and then it's left to brew for up to 5 weeks. And we do everything at the restaurant by hand on the 2 days that we're closed.
Oh, wow.
So it's actually
there are no weekends.
A lot of work for us to do. We don't have any huge tanks or anything. Everything is done in buckets, and we move them around by hand. And, you know, we strain them and drive them out to a pasteurization facility and a bottling facility that's like an hour away. I would say it's as close to a garage company as we can get, even though we're still Noma.
Yeah,
you know, because we've done something that, even though you might, Francis, know what garum is and have heard of it and know a little bit of it, most people have no clue what it is, sure. Let alone how to use it. So it's hard, you know, to figure out, okay, here's a new product. You never heard of it and you don't know how to use it. Great. Let's sell you some. And at the same time, less and less people actually cooking in their homes. And it is a cooking sauce. You know, it's a thing that's meant for you to flavor. But I just believe in it so much. It has given us so much at the restaurant. This is one product. We have dozens of garums in our pantry. And I genuinely believe in the power of these sort of condiments, whether it be a miso or a fantastic soy sauce or a smoked mushroom garum or a great vinegar. These are the key factors for deliciousness. And deliciousness is one of the key factors to happiness.
Yeah, for sure. So actually, let's talk about using this. You know, it's one thing for you to use them in the restaurant, you know, when you have extraordinarily, you know, finely tuned preparations and things like that. But like, you start bringing these home at some point, and you know, you're just making dinner at home with them. How do you like to use your smoked mushroom garum at home?
Yeah. So I was speaking to Nadine, my wife, yesterday about when we actually start bringing them home, and it was she says that it was in 2013.
Okay.
I start bringing them home, the different garums, and at first we cured egg yolks in it, much like you can cure egg yolk in soy sauce. We would take the mushroom garum and we would dunk fresh egg yolks in it.
Oh, cool.
And then we'd eat them for breakfast over steamed rice. That was the first version of it that we did at home. Then we start cooking mushrooms, which by far is one of my most favorite ways to use a smoked mushroom garum, is with mushrooms.
Okay.
And if you learn how to use mushrooms in your cooking, a world opens up to you unlike anything. And I think people, if they could just see mushrooms as almost like a, you know, think of mushrooms as like your chicken, the thing that you can eat with everything and the thing that goes with everything, as long as you learn how to cook it. So if you deeply caramelize mushrooms and then at the very last moment you add a little bit of butter or olive oil to the pan and then you pour on some garum to glaze in, and from that moment you can use these mushrooms for an array of things. You pour over, I've done that at home, I pour over rooibos tea, and then I add cooked noodles with it, and a cooked egg for a vegetarian serving. No animals harmed in this, other than we took, of course, an egg. Sometimes we also add cream to these sautéed mushrooms as that are just glazed. We add a bit of cream to the pan. And then, you know, you fold in either cooked vegetables or cooked pasta, which is always a huge favorite for our family, particularly the kids. Everything with cream in it, they totally adore.
Yeah.
And last week we made, which is another huge favorite for our family, but also when we have friends around and we're like making like an appetizer, and then we put this creamed mixture of mushrooms on a butter cooked toast of country loaf.
That sounds great.
With basil leaves on top. And it just really works. So
that sounds
Like it in that, but I have used it in everything. And the funny thing is, since we've released this, we're seeing all these recipes come back to us. Somebody has coined the word garamel, and they used they made a caramel where when caramelizing the sugar at the very last end, when you know, when usually you add water, they add garum to it.
Oh, cool!
And then so they made some sort of pie with it. It's savory.
Yeah, that sounds amazing.
And so this is actually quite fun right now, seeing how people are using it out there in places like, you know, the Midwest of America or in Newcastle of England. It's truly amazing to do this. And I can also honestly say it's like delightful to have something that we do that people are actually using. It's a new thing to us.
Yeah, that's amazing. Actually, now that you're mentioning it, I saw on Instagram Mike Bagale, who was the executive chef at Alinea, not there anymore, but I think he just poured some into his eggs while he was stirring the eggs in the bowl, scrambled them, and then said this was the most amazing simple meal, just those scrambled eggs with the garum in it. So yeah, I'm looking forward to experimenting now that I've cracked the seal.
Exactly, and I think when it comes to home cooking, I think sometimes when you have people that do it regularly, it can sound so easy. And I don't want to come across as saying that, you know, cooking is easy, because I do think cooking is easy, but I do it every day. I do it all the time. For me,
yeah,
to take a spoonful of garum and a head of broccoli and some basil leaves, that's enough for me to actually have a main course.
Sure.
But if you're not cooking regularly, it can be like starting to work out. It's hard at the beginning, and it may be even painful. But once you crack the code and get to understand how things work together, and you have a toolbox of potent flavors, it's really, really amazing. It's fun.
Yeah.
I've also heard a lot of people that put into their salad dressings. So when they make some sort of creamy salad dressing, they will put a spoonful of garum into it.
That sounds awesome. Well, thanks so much, Chef. It's been fun talking with you, and I can't wait to play with this.
Thank you so much. Take care.
René Redzepi is the chef owner of restaurant Noma in Copenhagen, co-author of the Noma Guide to Fermentation, and proprietor of Noma Projects. You can find a recipe from the Noma Fermentation Lab for roasted chicken wing garum at splendidtable.org. I have never made it, and I've always wanted to, so let me know if you do. Okay, so we're going from the modern fishless version of the ancient fish sauce called garum to, well, just fish sauce as we know it today. Made by fermenting tiny fishes in salt, fish sauce is one of the universe's great flavor boosters, and many cuisines, especially Thai and Vietnamese, are built on it. Deep Tran is a chef who does research and development for Red Boat Fish Sauce. They're an artisanal fish sauce company. They're based in California, but they make the stuff the old-fashioned way, on the island of Phu Quoc, Vietnam. Hey, Chef. It's great to have you.
Hi, Francis. Thanks for having me on.
Okay, we're going to start with just the total basics, right?
Okay.
What is fish sauce?
Okay.
And how's it made, I guess? Maybe as an addendum.
Okay, so fish sauce, let me tell you how Red Boat does fish sauce. And then,
okay.
Yeah, so Red Boat fish sauce is a very deceptively simple but very complicated fermentation process. But literally, it's just black anchovies from off the coast of the Phu Quoc Island, and it's just salted, and then it's fermented for 12 months until it becomes an elixir, and then you strain it, and then you have fish sauce that you see at the market. Now, that sounds really easy, but at the same time, anyone who's fermented anything will know that fermentation has its own mind, and it is...
Nature has a way of interceding.
I know. She doesn't follow your needs, you know, so you accommodate her.
Exactly.
And so, you know, in Vietnamese, it's actually not Mother Nature. It's Ông Trời, which is like a male god, you know, like Father Sky or Mr. Sky. So it's exceptionally simple but fermentation, like, you know, why certain cheeses taste better in certain regions, that also holds true for fish sauce. And most people will say that Phu Quoc Island produces the best fish sauce. And part of that is what Gung, the founder of Red Boat Fish Sauce, talks about is the terroir, you know, because it's very hot and humid. And so that fermentation is just very active versus if you're in a colder climate, you have to do all, like, fish sauce in the north, it's done a little differently. But here in Phu Quoc, it's just, you put salt, you put it in a barrel with the fish, and just let it go. Gung learned that actually, like, he has his own fleet of fishermen who work for Red Boat. And so he instructs them, like, once you pull the fish out of the water, you salt it immediately. And he has found that makes a difference versus waiting till you get into the onto the shore to do it. Mm-hmm. He salts it immediately. So anyway, in a nutshell, fish sauce is fermented fish that's been fermented with salt being the agent.
Oh, cool.
That's
okay,
That's long.
Well, you know, as you said, it was deceptively simple. So you just described how Red Boat makes its fish sauce, and I am a fan of Red Boat, but I'm also a fan of other sauces too, and like maybe some of the more commercial industrial ones. How does that process differ?
Well, I can't speak to the nitty gritty of it, but when you look at the label, you can see that there are different ingredients in addition just to salt and fish. And so that just means that it's, you know, it's a commercial industrialized product. You know, it's like mm-hmm. you're trying to get like the same flavor every time. You're trying to get like the you're gonna try to stretch as much product out of like your resources sure. as you can. So you have to add certain things to kind of make it taste like that. That's the kind of stuff that you see at the market, and it's reflective on the price. And no shade mm-hmm. to it at all. You know, it's their formula in order to get to the flavor that they want to get mm-hmm. to. But, you know, like, I think most families have more than one brand at home, mm-hmm, you know, mm-hmm, for mm-hmm. different purposes.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I appreciate you said it's you know, it's not a matter of shade. It's just like, oh, it's a different thing. It's industrial versus artisanal. And like you said, they have different places in the world. So talking about fish sauce in general, like, it is sort of an all-purpose seasoning, mm-hmm. Certainly in Vietnamese cuisine and, you know, many other Southeast Asian cuisines. Are there particular uses for it where you feel it really shines?
You know, I'm trying to think of a place that for fish sauce doesn't kind of help. And I can't think of it. You know, like, it's great in desserts. You know, if you like to put a little salt in your dessert, you know, put a little fish sauce in there. You know, like, we had a very limited run of Le Bon Garçon manufactured or created caramels. He's a confectioner in LA. He also did, like, because we couldn't use the word Chex Mix, we called it bric-a-brac. And so it was like caramel bric-a-brac. We had an ice cream maker make fish sauce ice cream, you know? So anywhere where, one, you want some umami, or anywhere where you want to have the interplay of sweet and salty, mm-hmm. then you can use it. So I think fish sauce belongs everywhere, like on fruit, yeah. you know? Like, dip a green mango in particular is great with some chili fish sauce. And you know, Vietnamese people and a lot of, you know, and like Latino populations know, like, a little salt in your watermelon tastes fantastic. So sure. yeah, so it belongs everywhere, Francis.
Sure. I'm with you. I'm with you. I am an avid lover of fish sauce, and it is sort of an all-purpose seasoning, right? So often when I'm cooking and I'm tasting as I go along, I'm just like, it needs a little salt, but also just needs some depth.
Yeah.
I often will just reach for the fish sauce, whether it's a Vietnamese dish or even an Asian dish or not. You know, it's a really wonderful way of adding salt and depth, just umami.
Yeah. And you know what's great? You know, I think fish sauce and butter are best friends. We have a recipe in the cookbook for pork chops, and the pork chops you usually get for broken rice is usually it's grilled, but we wanted to do it with a pan seared, because the grilling of pork chops, I find, like, I've never been able to do it where it hasn't dried out. And so we pan seared it with, I tried it with butter, you know, I mean, I always knew that butter and fish sauce goes together, but it was just like, it just, the lemongrass in it with the butter, because it's relatively high heat, so it browns it a little bit, it caramelizes, and just like the juice you get from that, pour it over rice.
Oh, that sounds great.
You know, delish.
Oh, this is so interesting. There's definitely, I'm sensing this like recurring theme of you of like thinking of fish sauce in terms of like a sweet and savory combination.
Yeah, most people love sweet and savory.
Yeah, I mean, turns out every human on earth.
Who doesn't?
But it's so interesting. So when you're thinking about like where to use fish sauce, if there's somewhere that needs savoriness but has some form of sweetness, even just the browning of butter, you know, something like that gives like a sensation of sweetness, I mean, that links up with fish sauce for you.
Yeah, because another kind of classic dish that we have in the cookbook is what we did when I did at Good Girl Dinette was
your restaurant.
Grilled corn with scallion mm-hmm. oil, you know, height of summer corn, deliciously sweet. And then you add scallions, which has its own sweetness, but it's more aromatic. And you have fish sauce. And it's just the interplay of like that bright sweetness with the depth of the fish sauce. It's just, I love dishes that are so super simple and it blows your mind. You know, like yeah. that's like corn, fish sauce, scallion. Like, you're done. You can have a whole plate of that and you'd be done.
Oh, that sounds so good.
Yeah, and it's actually the dish that when I served it at Good Girl Dinette, you know, people were like, oh, I'm not into fish sauce. I'm like, that's fine. You know, other people will be. Don't care. You know, but they saw like every table had it and so they ordered it. And they'd be the ones that are just like taking their finger and just like scraping the plate afterwards. I'm like, I thought you didn't love fish sauce, girl.
We're talking to Deep Tran, R&D chef of Red Boat Fish Sauce and co-author of the Red Boat Fish Sauce Cookbook. We'll be back with her in a minute. I'm Francis Lam, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. Our show is supported by Hero Bread. You know, for a lot of us, bread has been a staple all our lives. Toast at breakfast, sandwiches at lunch, a nice buttered roll at dinner. It's comforting and delicious, and bread is often what we crave, but sometimes it can sit a little heavy after a meal. That's where Hero Bread comes in. They've created fluffy, delicious versions of the breads that we're used to, but that include no net carbs, 0 grams of sugar, and fewer calories. Oh, and there's more good stuff too, like protein and fiber. Hero Bread has everything from your daily sandwich loaf to tortillas or hot dog and hamburger buns. The products are flavorful and they have something for every craving, from a dressed-up breakfast burrito to a late-night PB&J. They even have monthly small-batch drops of indulgent treats like 2-gram net-carb Hero Croissant or the 1-gram net-carb Hero Cheddar Biscuit. Don't give up being a breadhead. Hero Bread is offering 10% off your order. Go to hero.co and use code TABLE at checkout. That's table at hero.co. I'm Francis Lam, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for curious cooks and eaters. We're talking to Deep Tran, author of the Red Boat Fish Sauce Cookbook, about the magical elixir that's fish sauce. Let's get back to it. I think a lot of people who think they don't like fish sauce, you know, it is an intense flavor, an intense aroma. And if you're not accustomed to it, you know, some people say it smells fishy. I personally don't think it smells fishy. It smells like fish sauce. But I also find that it seems to be that when you cook fish sauce versus using it raw, that the flavor and the aroma changes like a lot. And I don't know is it just in my head? Like, can you speak to that? Because I do feel like you said, like, oh, once you've cooked it, and like you described with the corn, with a little bit something sweet, even people who think they don't like fish sauce, you know, just can't get enough of it.
Yeah, and I think, like, you know, I never apologize for the aroma. So it's not like, you know, when you cook fish sauce, it's not to tamp down the aroma. You have to remember that fish sauce, especially like a product like Red Boat, is a raw product. So just like wine, when you cook wine, you expel some of the rawness of it, and that's what you're noticing, is that fish sauce takes on a different character once it gets heated, you know, and becomes like a different thing. So yes, and that way it plays a little better with other ingredients. It kind of takes a back note versus like a raw, like a nuk jam, which you don't cook. It takes a more assertive, you know, because you want that, because in the nuk jam you're competing with lime or some sort of acid, sugar, garlic.
Well, so actually, tell us what nuk jam is.
Nuk jam is kind of like a catch-all term that's known in the U.S. For like a fish sauce based dip. Or dressing.
Yeah. Yes. What are the components of a typical nuk jam?
Okay.
Because you have a whole chart of how to make it different ways in the book. So
like, I do.
What do you think is a standard? And tell us about how you like to use it.
Well,
and then how you like to mess with it.
When co-author Thien and I, we were talking about, like, you know, we definitely need nuk jam in this cookbook. And I said, we should do a whole spectrum. And she got super excited about it. So we were like, what would be in that? And so we wanted to like teach people the basic. We do have a thing called like an all-purpose, but there's the realm of nuk jam is amazing. But you have like these certain kind of like starter rules, you know, which you start with the fish sauce, which is like, let's think of it as your salty agent, right?
Okay.
And you want to have some acid, and the acid could come from anything from like distilled vinegar to calamansi to lime. Apple cider vinegar, we like apple cider vinegar too. And then you would have aromatics, usually, you know, like most of them would involve like a garlic, you know. But you can add other aromatics, like, you know, like ginger or lemongrass. Right. Because these all play together, because aroma is flavor, right? So you're just kind of building on the fish sauce, like, you know, fish sauce, oh, it plays well with these herbs, let's put those in, you know. And then you would have you would sometimes have like a fat, like you would replace, you know, the water with coconut water, or add peanuts to it. That adds a fattiness to it, you know. So there's like all different ways. And so we kind of like walk people through, like, here's your nuk jam that you would encounter at a lot of Vietnamese restaurants.
Yeah, where you would like dip the spring rolls in.
And, yes.
Oh, actually, so just so we have it. So that would typically be fish sauce.
Yes.
Lime juice or other acid.
Mm-hmm.
Sugar.
Mm-hmm.
Water. And maybe like some minced garlic. And yes. Maybe some minced
chilies. And chilies.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's amazing because it's sweet, sour, savory, salty, and with these aromatics. It's like it kind of hits.
You sense a pattern?
Yeah. It kind of hits everything you need to yes. hit.
Yeah. Yeah, it's your MVP, really. Yeah.
Great. Well, I love that stuff, and I do make a jar of it and keep it in my fridge. And I always know if I have nothing else going on, I can have a bowl of rice and even like fry an egg, or you know, sear a piece of fish or sear a piece of meat or something, and then just splash that on and
or like, tofu
or tofu. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree. I mean, that's like the. You know, I don't have my life together, but I gotta eat tonight. Yeah, that's definitely my meal. Yeah.
All right, dude. Well, thank you so much for coming in.
Oh, thank you so much. This is so fun. Thanks for inviting me.
Deep Tran is the co-author of the Red Boat Fish Sauce Cookbook. She left us with a recipe for those pork chops she loves. Find Cam Tam, seared pork chops with broken rice at splendidtable.org. You know, the words hydrolyzed vegetable protein may or may not be the most romantic ones you've ever heard, but if you've never heard those words, you're missing out. I mean, first of all, it's probably in like half the snack chips you love, but it's also the key ingredient in one of the greatest condiments in the world, Maggi. Beloved by cooks from Mexico to Nigeria to India to China and beyond, our friend Kushbu Shah, restaurant editor of Food & Wine magazine, once explored the wide world of Maggi and lived to tell a tale. Hey, Kushbu. It's great to see you.
Hello, Francis.
You know, we have been talking about truly wonderful things today on this episode. We've been talking about artisanal fish sauce. We've been talking about garums made in one of the best restaurants in the world.
Ooh.
But there is one seasoning brand that is completely non-artisanal, super industrial, and absolutely beloved by literally two-thirds of the world's cooks. Could you take us into the world of Maggi sauce? What is Maggi sauce?
Oh, man. What isn't Maggi sauce is probably a better question. Maggi is magic. I've also realized and come to learn that some cultures call it Maggi and some cultures call it Maggi, which is fascinating.
Oh, yeah.
So there's like a divide in that. Maggi is so many things to so many people. Ultimately, some people know it as a sauce. If you're Indian, you know it as like an instant noodle. If you are from Pakistan or the Middle East, it's often Maggi means bouillon cubes. But everything Maggi does is tasty and only makes your food taste better ultimately. Yeah. So it's a seasoning sauce that's super, everything is umami at the end of the day. It all comes down to being something very umami that you add to your food.
Okay, cool. Okay, well, let's start with the sauce because I have my biases. And in my mind, Maggi has always been a sauce.
Uh-huh.
Little bottle, looks like soy sauce. Mm-hmm. Usually, like, I don't know if other people have different styles of bottle, but for us, it was almost like a square bottom bottle that like
with,
comes
like a slender
up to a
neck.
Nice, slender, graceful neck. The colors are always yellow and red. Apparently, depending on where you are in the world, there's like a like some have like a red cap and some have a yellow cap, and there's like a whole sort of code there. But let's start with the sauce. How would you describe this sauce?
Well, it depends on what country you're in.
Oh, man.
So
okay.
There, Maggi makes different sauces for different countries in sort of similar bottles. So in Vietnam, it's like Vietnamese Maggi is very savory, very punchy. It is like soy sauce in that it adds like a, such a deep note to all the food. It's like that flavor that you can't quite pinpoint sometimes, but it's like the thing that makes it delicious. If it's not there, you'll notice. Like mm-hmm. a proper banh mi has like Maggi sauce like drizzled on it,
okay.
which is not always the case in the States. But if you like, yeah, a proper banh mi must have Maggi, actually. but you go to Mexico and it's known as Maggi Jugo, and it's a little more syrupy. It's like, I think, a tinge sweeter. Still has this like deep flavor note. It's also available in Germany, and it tastes more like lovage, like that herb. So it ranges. It depends on like where you're picking up your Maggi. Yeah.
Okay, so that's fascinating. So the version we had, and I don't know if we had an American version or if we had a Chinese version, you know, like I don't know what was available to, I'm sure we bought it in Chinese markets, but maybe it was, you know, I don't know if it was like the version that they actually sell in Hong Kong or China, but to me, it always tasted like a little bit like a sweeter soy sauce with sort of like a more herbal vibe. You know, soy sauce is made from soybeans and, you know, a particular mold and enzyme that ferments it and makes it, you know, deep and delicious. But there's not really an herbal note to soy sauce. And like Maggie has that sort of slightly herbal note with those kind of brown, savory, you know, flavors underneath it.
Yeah. If you tell an Indian person Maggie sauce, it's kind of like a riff on like a tamarind chutney almost, but like,
oh, cool.
It's like almost tamarind chutney meets ketchup. And it's the best thing to put on like veggie burgers, fries, eat with samosas. Like it's a great all-in-one kind of condiment. But from the Maggies that I've had, I've also not had every single global Maggie. Maggie Hugo does taste very different to me than kind of the more Chinese Maggie sauce that I've had and the Vietnamese Maggie that I've had. But I don't know if in a blind taste test I could tell you which one was which. Yeah.
Okay. So it's like, it's kind of like you just have to be like a Maggie collector, a Maggie connoisseur, and really like taste your way through the world and find the one that works for you.
Yes.
Okay. So there are like the thin brown Maggie sauces. And then, like you said, there's like the tamarind that's like a thicker, more ketchup-y
sort of. Yeah. It comes in like a big glass bottle. It doesn't have that slender neck. It isn't just a couple of drops. Like, you know, you really shake it out of the bottle to, like, you know, it's like ketchup almost. You treat it that way. In the way that you would treat this sort of Maggie Hugo is more of a soy sauce seasoning type thing. This is more a condiment. And there's also Maggie chili garlic sauce. You know, they have a whole range of sauces too that are more like condiments than they are flavor amplifiers, I guess. Is that maybe the best way to categorize it? Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so like for like the thin liquidy sauce varieties, like the Maggie sauce of my youth, what is it made of? It's not soybeans. Fish sauce is made of fish and salt. Soy sauce is made of soybeans and salt and, you know, enzymes.
Yes.
What is Maggie sauce made of?
I think they keep the recipes pretty secret, if I remember correctly.
No one knows.
It just like no one knows. I think some of them do have MSG in them. Some of them have different herbs. It really is like a Swiss Army knife of sauces. And it's a Swiss company that makes it from my understanding, when I talked to them, they're not owned by Nestle, but when I talked to them for a story that I did, they said that they regionalize it per country. So per country's palate, they have different scientists kind of like working on it, you know, the food scientists, but like they wouldn't tell me exactly what separates it. They just know. They just know what, you know, Mexico wants out of the sauce versus what China wants out of the sauce versus what,
So, like, you're, like, journalist, like, alarm didn't go off. You're like, oh, you're avoiding the question right now. What you're doing. You're like, what's in this? Oh, we change it. It's local to every country. But what's in it? You know, whatever any country wants.
It's many layers to even get an answer from them. So, yeah. I was honored to get an email back from a Maggie scientist. Yeah, at that point.
Okay, well, all we know, it is incredibly delicious. It is beloved around the world. Okay, so beyond the soy saucy, fish saucy, thin brown liquid versions, there's like the condiment version, like you talked about, like the tamarind sauce. It's like a thicker, you know, thicker thing you would pour on stuff rather than like shake into stuff or season with. But there's also bouillon cubes, which are incredibly popular, like you said, in the Middle East. And I think the chef Kwame Onwuachi is always talking about.
Also very popular in Caribbean cooking. Yeah.
Yeah. He uses a lot in his Caribbean and like West African recipes. So tell us about the Maggie bouillon cubes.
They're, again, basically just like little MSG bombs, ultimately. You know, there's chicken, there's beef, they're, you know, just little seasoning bombs that you just add to your rice, that you add to broths, that you add to stews. You know, it's just the little thing that you add that just takes it to the next level. It's just immediate concentrated flavor, and they've just managed to, I don't know, dominate the market as far as flavor, you know, amplifiers go. Yeah.
Yeah. How did that domination happen? Like you said, it's like it started in Switzerland. How is it like, you know, Nigerian cooks are making stuff with it and Chinese cooks are making stuff with it?
Yeah, I think they were just very smart to figure out what the local markets needed or loved. You know, they when they introduce, so Maggi in India means instant noodles, but it's not instant noodles in the way that a lot of us think of ramen. The Maggi seasoning packets in India are very much oriented to the Indian palate. It is very much like Indian seasonings. Mm-hmm. It's masala Maggi is what it's actually called. And so it's so like hyper-localized in the way that Starbucks, you know, does a really good job of that. Like if you go, or McDonald's, like if you go to any country, it's very much a good representation of how that country tends to like to eat as a baseline. Maggi has managed to kind of do the same thing.
So of the versions you tried, what are some of your favorite ways to taste them, eat them? I know you said the instant noodles are obviously, it's its own thing, but the Maggi sauces, the Maggi condiments, the Maggi bouillon cubes, what are your favorite ways to use them?
Yeah, I love Maggi Jugo. I really do. The Mexican version, especially like a little drizzle and some soup. Honestly, also the Chinese Maggi on just rice with some butter, like over, you know, in the way that like soy sauce butter rice is like amazing. Actually, Maggi butter rice kind of takes it to a new level. I really, really love it. And then there is this Pakistani like broth that's made called yakni, and putting Maggi bouillon cubes in that kind of really just adds like a new level to it. And it's the most delicious kind of comforting.
What else is in it?
Brothy, clear soup. It's usually, from my understanding, like a goat broth, like it's an animal broth basically that they make, and then it can go into other things, or you can just eat it on its own. And it just, when you add the Maggi to it, it just, I don't know,
you just drop the bouillon cube,
and yeah, then
it's like, it, you when know, you want kind of, to go extra,
exactly. Yeah. No,
God, I remember, like I said, I grew up with Maggi in the house, and we always had a bottle of it on the table along with white pepper and chili sauce, and you know. And soy sauce, you know, just a couple of seasonings that we always had on the table for every meal. Mm-hmm. So yeah, we would just use it like in place of salt if we wanted, you know, to season things at the table. But I do remember it was like incredible revelation when someone shook a few drops of it onto just a regular like ham sandwich with mayonnaise and a few cracks of white pepper. And it was so incredibly delicious. And now that I'm thinking about it. You said, oh, in Vietnam, a banh mi has to have Maggi in it. It's like, oh, it's mayonnaise, the Maggi.
The pate, you know, like, yeah.
Yeah, that combination of mayonnaise and Maggi on a sandwich is, woohoo.
Honestly, it's good even in a little bit of, like, if you scramble eggs and you just toss a little in there. I really like it. It makes it, like, deeply savory for me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yum. And I know it's not cool. I know it's like laden with MSG, but you know what? Literally 2/3 of the world loves it. So like,
honestly, everything good we can't has all MSG be wrong. In it. Yeah.
All right,
let's
Kushru,
be honest.
Thank you so much for coming through.
No, thank you for having me.
Kushbu Shah is the restaurant editor at Food & Wine, and you can read her story on the world of Maggi in the Washington Post. Well, that's our show for the week. And remember, if you ever have any cooking questions for us, record them as a voice memo on your phone and email them. contact@splendidtable.org. Talk to you soon. APM Studios are run by Chandra Kavati, Alex Schaffert, and Joanne Griffith. Beth Perlman's our executive producer, and The Splendid Table is created by Sally Swift and Lynn Rosetto Casper. It's made every week by technical producer Jennifer Lukey, producer Erica Romero, digital producer James Napoli, and managing producer Sally Swift. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is APM Studios. All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.